Alan Quinn Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3, for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 15, delivered on March 27, 2017. The title of this lecture is Investment Decision Making.
Today, investment decision making. This is not a hard topic, but as usual, it can be made difficult if you write the problem appropriately. And I will take you through it. I'll show you how to do these on two different kinds of calculators. And if you want to do it by hand, more power to you. If you want to use tables, well, again, that's on you, not on me. But before I start, just to keep pushing on this whole idea I've been trying to get across of being able to read screens and this helps you to begin to think about businesses as value representing the present value of future expected cash flows. More specifically, this is the net present value of future expected cash flows. So, and that's the top one of the topics of today's lecture. But if you look at this, the quick screens, is this an up or a down day, or is this sort of a day that is just sort of sitting in the water, you can't tell one way or the other? What would you say, sir? That's not even enough to make me sound like Scooby-Doo. That is, it's just a little bit of a notch down on a couple of the indices, a notch up on another one. This is a quiet day. And again, representing, as I told you before, that lull you get in before earnings are released, and the market just takes a wait-and-see attitude. Now, the market has already put in what it thinks is going to go on. The expectation is already there. What's going to happen is when the earnings are released, surprises will show up here. But to say, well, the earnings are released and it was as expected, earnings were up, so the stock price went up. No, the stock price went up if the expectation was already there. And now we wait to all we're waiting to see is whether we are confirmed or if there's something that we weren't expecting to happen. So, in general, we already know what's going to happen. These earnings reports are pretty much we know, but we're just waiting to make sure we know what happened. And again, sometimes there's a little surprise in there that we didn't see coming. But the insiders, the Wall Street boys and all that, they know what's going to happen before it happens. As a matter of fact, they have told the companies in many regards, this is what's going to happen, and this is what you're going to put. So there, if the idea that you're going to beat this market, dream on. But at the same time, it's worth it for us to have a look at companies and see what they are. One thing that I do want to look at here is, let me do this. Just to look at a couple, just to make sure that you're on board with this. As a matter of fact, let me do this one. This one's one I haven't done, I don't think, this semester. Kroger, again, consumer, a little bit down, just following the market down. Now, before you even see the volume for the day versus the average volume, what do you expect to see? Talk to me. What do you expect to see, sir? I would expect it to be lower, just that wait and see, but we don't know yet. Let's have a look. Yep, you're beginning to get to be a stock analyst, aren't you? Well, I'll be darned. That's exactly what all of you will begin to get to be, is there's nothing genius about it. Don't get a big head, fool. No, it's the deal, though, is that it's not like we are stupid, and you guys are getting the education you need to be able to do what the analysts do. We already know pretty much, and if it had been above it, then we would have been surprised, and we would have gotten real excited and started looking around for what had happened. But in this case, nothing much had happened. Now, looking at the 5 years on, a couple of things that are worth looking at here real quick is that it was down a little bit, but it wasn't anything spectacular. It's just following the market trends. This is, okay, is this a risky or a safe stock? Can you tell me that? Just anyone. I'm having a hard time walking for a few minutes here. Sciatica kills me. It's a very safe stock. This is a beta of 0.29. Price earnings ratio is 14. There's nothing really spectacular about that. You got it, basically grandma stock. This is a good, solid stock. It's got a nice little dividend that goes with it. Dividend yield's about a little above 1.5%. So you put in $28.93 a share. So in other words, you invest $2,893 plus your commission, and you're going to get a check every year. It'll actually come in quarterly installments, but you'll get a check every year for $48 for 100 shares. So it's like a passbook savings account. This one is never going to rise spectacularly. It's not going to be some, gee whiz, wow, I'm making a big bucks off this. This is a safe stock. You don't expect a significant capital gain. You buy this one more for the dividend and for modest price appreciation in the stock, not for some Hail Mary that's going to happen with it. A prudent investment. Probably it would fit into almost any portfolio, but I'd expect to see things like Kroger in a middle-aged couple's portfolio, maybe around the age of 40 to 50. I'd start to see Kroger along with other lower beta stocks showing up. Now, as far as the range, the 52-week range goes, is this near its low or its high? What do you say? Based on 52 weeks, is the stock today near its low or near its high? Yeah, it's near its low. See how it's swung over the last 52 weeks from about 28 and a quarter to 39 and a quarter. And right now it's at 28, just a little under 29. So again, surprising that I've shown you a number of stocks that are near their lows right now. We have a market that seems to be interested in testing the lows, and so we want to keep an eye on a broad base, because if a bunch of stocks suddenly start punching that neckline on the downside, that's the kind of stuff that gets us all kinds of interested in what we would call a market correction. Now, a couple of terms, I've brought them up before, and I want to make them formal: a bear and a bull. Okay, you probably already know, what's a bull? Yeah, it's one of those things. No. In stock market terms, what's a bull? You know? Okay, it's one who believes that stocks are going to go up in price. A bear is someone who believes that stock prices are going to go down. So when you see prices going up, you say the bulls are on the run. The bulls are running out the bears. But when you see the stock prices sitting down here at the bottom, you see the bears and the bulls getting ready for a little fight. This is one of those things like, you know, this isn't Call of Duty, and they don't carry weapons, but think of this sort of like an old game like Tekken. Right before something is going to give. It's quiet here on the street, and you see that there are a number of stocks who are sitting near their necklines on the downside, but they haven't broken their neckline lines on the downside. So we just have to kind of watch this to see what's going to happen. If I start over in the next few days, and I'm going to show you screens every day just to get you enculturated to the way we do things, not just in finance, but as business people being interested in this kind of thing. Well, there's a lot to be said for keeping an eye here, because if we start seeing necklines broken, in a random sample. Maybe you sample about 10 stocks. Just quickly have a look, see if any of them are breaking necklines. If more than one or two are breaking necklines, that's when I begin to start to worry about the market and I start doing some portfolio readjustments. Now, the next thing I want to bring up is long versus short. Long versus short. If I say I am long Kroger, that means that I have a buy position. I own Kroger stock. I am betting that it will go up. And yes, it is a bet. This is Las Vegas, except that you don't get martinis while you're doing your business. Well, you can, but you have to hide them in a coffee cup. Anyway, but okay, on the other side of this, the short position is a little more complicated, but it's a bet that the market is going to go down. If I short a stock, what I do is I borrow the stock, and then I wait for the price to go down. Then I buy the stock at the lower price and give it back to where I borrowed it. That's a short position. Again, I borrow stock at 100, and then I sell it. I should have said that. I sell it at 100. And then I buy it back at 90, and then I pocket the difference between 100 and 90. I give the stock back once after I've borrowed it. So in other words, I'm borrowing what's not mine, selling what's not mine, and then if it goes down, I buy it and give it back to the person I had originally borrowed it from, so I wash my position out, and I've pocketed the difference between what I borrowed it at, what I originally borrowed it at, and what I sold it at, what I bought it back at the end. That's a short position in a stock. People look at the buying of stock all the time. Everyone looks at long. Everything you see here is pretty much long information. You also want to look at short information. Short interest outstanding. In other words, how many people are borrowing this stock betting that it's going to go down? That is a little bit less obvious from the quickie screens, because the quickie screens are biased toward the buy position, which they should be. Stock markets, by their nature, will go up over time. That does not mean that they always go up, and that does not mean that they're going to go up today or tomorrow. So in other words, when I see this kind of neckline playing, I'm on the fence. On the one hand, this could be, as a bull, I would say this is a buy opportunity if it doesn't break the neckline. I will go long if I don't see it breaking the neckline. If I'm a bear, I'm going to say as soon as that thing goes below the neckline, I'm going to open short positions on this because I believe that it will go down. So bears short, bulls long. Bears short, bulls long. Now, this is only the beginning of knowledge for you, but it's where you begin to be able to talk like us and to begin to think like us, because the language that we talk in is the language we think in. And so, in other words, in this one right here, I mean, a bull and a bear could see completely different things in this very same screen. The bull, like I said, says, well, it's down near its neckline, but it isn't breaking it. The bear is going to say, yeah, it's down near its neckline. It's going to go right through that thing, and it's going to go on a bear rampage. You ever seen a bear walk into a store? Everyone leaves, you know? So that's the way the stock market works, too. The bear walks in and starts, and you go away. I've seen those movies like that, The Revenant and all that. It certainly wasn't Winnie the Pooh that was eating that guy. Another stock. Kroger is a consumer stock. Halliburton is a war stock. It feeds itself on wars. Quiet. down 3.3%. But isn't that interesting? Look at that. What do you see about the volume on a war stock? Yeah, it's well above its average for the day, which concerns me. It's down. So in other words, it was the sell activity, the sell side, the bear side was harder than the bull side. But at the same time, I'm looking at this guy on its 52-week from 33.25 to 58.25. We've got it. That's about in the middle of it. It's hard to call. This isn't going to be telling us anything from neckline breaks. This is going to be something else. Not sure. It's losing money out the ass right now, but I don't worry too much about that. That's accounting. We need to talk about cash flow, and that's something you're going to hear me say over and over again now in this part of the course when I say the free cash flow. In other words, how much money is left after you pay your bills? Not how much accounting book money is, how much money is left, okay? And it's hard to call this one. Hard to call. Got any others that you want to see right now? Anything of interest? Kellogg's? Good. K. Naturally for Special K. Okay, there we go. Oh, well, spank me Jesus. Look at it. Volume. No offense, Rabbi. Volume. Hard up volume. But do you see how the bears are winning a little bit today when I look at these stocks? Strong volume on two that went down. So that means strong, the bears took the lead on this one. If I'm looking at this one, is it near its 52-week low or near its 52-week high? What do you see? Near the low. And so we've got a potential for a neckline break here. Beta. Okay, what do you see beta and price earnings ratio? Are they telling you the same thing or are they talking different languages to you? What do you see here? Madam, what do you see?
Very different.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. That's exactly right. The beta and the PE ratio are saying very different things to me. And as my rule goes, now, well, let me ask you, are you a happy, sunny, everything's going to work out in the end kind of person? Good. It's better to be on the risk-averse side, on the darkened side of this. And this one, I would say that the price-earnings ratio is telling me more than the beta is here. There's no one absolute piece of information. There's no one absolute god of finance, except for me, of course. But other than that, you can't just say, well, one's telling the beta is small, so that's all that matters. No, you have a disagreement here, and my concern is that that price-earnings ratio is probably giving a more accurate perspective on this one. I don't know, though. It's a tough call. What would be causing this? And this is where you get into other courses. If you take me for a higher level course, or if you take some of the courses in marketing, in management, you begin to see the different aspects, the different what could be going on here. Is it grain? Probably not. We've got these damn bumper crops coming along. Grain prices are ridiculously low. Farmers are getting their butts beaten by the low prices. So it's not their internal factor cost that would be driving down the price. Global demand, well, there should be pretty strong global demand. We're doing a lot better than we used to getting food to places that need it the most. Hard to call what it's about. My big thing would be to say this is a consumer-oriented company. That's probably where the big issue is. Consumer-oriented companies, even those that provide staples, are more sensitive to economic swings in the short run. So this might be just Kellogg's beginning the investors realigning their portfolios to pare down their holdings of some of the companies that would be more sensitive to a recessionary environment. to a situation where cereals, families would still buy cereals, but they might tend to buy generics rather than the big fancy brands and all that kind of stuff. It's hard to call, though, what's going on here. That's where you start to look and learn about business. And it's not all about finance. We can do it, but other courses can help you out too. Like I said, marketing's a great place if they can keep away from the stupid psychobabble and talk about the real nitty-gritty of marketing, the cool stuff. Okay, enough of that. Now, a little more you've seen about that. And you have a few more terms in your portfolio to use. Now, I've put up a calculator. And I'm putting up the calculators. I put up a TI 83 Plus and the Pearson Financial Calculator. I will show you these routines on both of them. This is actually no-brainer kind of stuff. But like I said, I can make these problems, anyone can make these problems so hard that you can't. Look, I had to modify. I was looking for some problems to put up. So they said, here's these canned problems that you can put up for homework, quizzes, and tests. They had a couple of problems in there. I was so confused, I couldn't find my own butt using both hands and a Rand McNally road atlas. And so, yeah, you can make these things so complicated, it's ridiculous. And I started, nope, not that one. They had one, and I finally thought, I really need to try to do this. And after a while, I started worshiping Satan at one point, seeing if he had anything he could contribute, and he said, screw that, I don't do finance. And so, I'm not going to put you through that kind of ridiculous stuff, although the bottom line is this. An asset has a value. It also has a price. Now, there's this theoretical thing, the price should be the value. In a perfect world, that's true. But then again, in an imperfect world, it's not true. But one way or the other, if we are looking to try to find the price of an asset, what we should pay, or whether we should take on a project, we have this very good, and it is a theory, that the value now is the present value of the future expected cash flows, minus what you pay. I mean, it sounds perfectly logical, but it is a theory. I mean, there are other ways that you could say it. What's the value of it? It's what my mom says. Or what's the value of it? Well, it's what I read in these tea leaves. Our way of doing this in business is to say everything, every asset, its value, and therefore we hope its price, is going to be the present value of the future expected cash flows, minus the costs. Now, oftentimes we will, and I'm going to modify this, tell you some real world stories, but oftentimes we will say, all right, the cost is up front. We're going to start a project. And then we're going to say, all right, what is this project going to bring in as far as free cash flow goes? In other words, the revenues, the dollar money amounts minus the expenses amount year over year. So let's say that I were to pay $5,000 up front to start a project. That would be at time zero. Now, in year one, this starts to generate some cash. $1,000 on the first year, $2,000 on the second year, $1,500 on the third year, and $750 on the fourth year. And this project has a salvage value of $600. Quick note about this before I go on. Salvage values. If you see a salvage value, just add it to the last year's cash flow. Now, an interesting thing about salvage value is a lot of companies don't think about salvage values. And a lot of companies don't react to salvage value. A perfect example of that, I'm going to tell you a secret here, okay? Now, you can't tell anyone I told you this. It's something really dark. Really, really dark, okay? Okay, you two. You look trustworthy. There is a room in the basement of this building that no one is allowed to go into. No one. It's haunted, you know. Ghosts of old technology. Oh, yeah, there are a few student bodies in there, too. I mean, they're skeletons now. I mean, you know, not even gristle left to chew on for you zombies in the crowd. But it's got all of these dead technology. I mean, you've got monitors, these little tiny, big, heavy monitors down there. You remember those? Are you old enough to remember the ones where the monitor was this tiny little screen? Yeah, those are down there. They got these floppy disks I'm sure almost none of you have ever seen. They were 8-inch floppy disks. They are this large, and they go, and you would click, and they hold a whopping 64K of data. And they're back in a room down there. Lots of them. Keyboards. I mean, some of those keyboards are in Sanskrit, I swear. But this is old, old technology. They never got rid of it, you see. Back at the time, they could have sold it. They could have donated and got tax stuff or whatever. But the point was they never did anything with it, and they wasted the opportunity to acquire a salvage value off old equipment. So just because you don't see a salvage value doesn't mean there wasn't one there. Think about opportunity cost. What did they give up by putting it down in the basement instead of getting off their lazy asses and taking it to a place that would buy that stuff? Even pennies on the dollar, it would have been better than putting it away. So keep in mind, if you ever see a project's cash flows and you don't see a salvage value at the end, you say, where is it? Oh, you know, well, we just threw that stuff away, or we put it somewhere, we don't know. You know, okay, then there is a value there. Doesn't mean it's a cost. You wasted a cost. You wasted something. So just keep in mind, salvage value is always part of it. So in other words, in this project, what I'll do is, for the last year's cash flow, I'm going to put $1,300. $1,250. The $600 plus the $750. Okay? Now, we're going to draw these back to the present. Now, these are future expected free cash flows. These are not revenues. These are not incomes off the project. They are free cash flows. In other words, money, dollars. Because quite honestly, and as the semester goes along, you might notice I'm getting harder in my position. We don't care what the accountants say. We care how much money came in and how much money went out. And so in this case, we have to keep that in mind, that this is free cash flow. And we're going to telescope these back, but we're going to need a discount rate to do it, to find the present values of each of these. And for now, and that's not the case for the permanently here, but for now, I'm going to pull a discount rate out of thin air. And we're going to do 8% on the discount rate, okay? Now, I can do this, and for one like this with an unlevel cash flow, I'll just take it back, and that'll be 1,000 times 1.08 to the negative first plus 2,000. Now, we're not going to do it like this forever. I hope to God not. Times 1.08 to the negative second. And then this one would be plus $1,500 times 1.08 to the negative third. And this one would be, is it 1350? You're right. I was just testing to see if you had that. so very glad you did that. Minus 4 to the negative 4th. And now we add those up, and then we add back the negative $5,000. Now, if I crank that very fast, hoping to that I can do it in one string calculation here. Okay, let me see if I can do it with this one. Okay, that's 1,000 times 1.08 to the negative first. That didn't work. Well, that's interesting. The exponent key didn't work there. And I can't see that screen well enough to know what the y, where the y to the x is. Wow. Oh, hat. Negative 1. What the heck is going on here? Okay. My color is meatloaf dense. Let me get this off. I want to keep this one because we'll do it this way, but let me use this calculator here. Okay, there, that should do it better. 1,000 times 1.08 to the negative first plus. I don't get this at all. Something is odd. Okay. I'll just keep pushing it. Someone, for God's sake, these times 1.08 to the wait. This is driving me crazy. I am absolutely at a loss here. Why the keyboard is not obeying me. 1,000 times 1.08 to the 1 plus neg plus, there we go, now it's beginning to behave itself, 2,000 times 1.08 to the, open parentheses, 2 plus neg, close parentheses, plus 1,500 times 1.08 to the 3 posneg. Whoops. Close parentheses. Plus 1,350 times 1.08 to the 4 posneg, close parentheses. Okay, 48,23,64. Now, taking away the original cost of the project, negative $176.36. This is what we call a negative net present value project. You reject it. It's as simple as that. If the NPV is positive, you accept. If the NPV is negative, you reject. That's all you do. It's a very simple decision-making criteria. And when finance people are given the projects that come out of, do I have a marketing major here? Anyone want to admit it? Okay. I shouldn't say that. But you might have a very good project, but if it does not, if it comes in with a negative net present value, it's no. It's just, that's it right there. That's the end of the story. Well, it was only negative by $4. No. Well, what if it had been negative by only 28 cents? No. Think of us as Grumpy Cat. No. Okay? That's how easy it is, but it's also how hard it is because there is nothing else that you can say. Now, I want you to notice something here, though. Here is the net present value on the vertical axis. And here is the discount rate on the horizontal axis. 1%, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. Okay, now, 100, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then on the vertical axis, negative 100, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so when we use an 8% discount rate, we got a negative $176.30. So at 8%, I was right about there. Negative net present value. What would have happened if I had used 6% instead and pushing it in very fast? Now watch what I'm going to do here. I'm going to use the Pearson calculator because it has a way to use uneven cash flows, do them pretty darn fast, okay? Watch. Hit reset, okay? Now, hit CF. We're going to do cash flow. The first thing it's going to say is how much money is starting it out. And in that case, that would be the $5,000. Pause neg. Okay? Whoops. Let's try that again. 5,000. Reset. Try that again. Cash flow. 5,000. Pause neg. Now go down. It's going to say, okay, now what was the first year's cash flow? And the first year's cash flow here was $1,000. Go down. It's going to say, how many times did that happen? Once, 1 year. Now go down. What was cash flow to? That was 2,000. Okay, now go down, and it's going to say how many years did that happen? Just one. So now we can go down. And it's going to say cash flow 3. How much was that? That was 1,500. Go down. How many times, how many years did that happen? Just one. See how cool this is? If you had a string of like 4 years of the same amount, you could just say 4. The only downside of that is that whacks off your count of the years as matching the numbers there. But other than that, now we go down. C4 was 1350. Down one. Okay, so now the last thing I want to do is say I over Y. I'm going to say that's 8% I over Y. And now compute the net present value. There it is. Isn't that nice? Yeah, a lot nicer than pounding. Let me tell you, when you do real ones where you got millions of dollars and you got like a 20-year project, you really begin to appreciate calculators like that. And maybe you'll appreciate what we had to go through before we had these calculators, how painful these were. Mm. But look, now the cool thing about this is, now let me see what would have happened if I had said, well, suppose that was a 6% I over Y. Okay? Compute the net present value. Oh my gosh, it's positive. At 6%, this is a positive net present value project. It's $50. So in other words, at 6%, it's up here. You see that as the discount rate gets higher, the present value gets lower. So watch this one. Let me do four here. Okay, I over Y, 4. I never know which way to do that. Okay, compute the NPV, $298. Wow. So at 4%, it's almost $300. Now let me do one more on the other side. Let me do a 10%. 10% I over Y. Compute the net present value. -388.90, almost 400. 10% is almost 400. So I want you to look. This is called a net present value profile, an NPV profile. It's a downward sloping line. It shows what discount rate you used, what your net present value is going to be. That thing right there, that little guy right there, that is the internal rate of return. It's not capitalized, it's just internal rate of return, IRR. Don't capitalize it when you write it out. You'll see me say, don't do that. It's just, it's not a proper noun. It's just internal rate of return. This, the internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project equal zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project equals zero. One more time. You notice why? Is there anything about when I keep repeating something over and over again? Probably it's going to show up somewhere. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that will make the net present value equal zero of a project equal zero. This is an important thing, you see, because every project will have its own unique internal rate of return. So I want you to tell me, okay, I've got a project, and I have found that the internal rate of return is 6.54%. I've got a project. This is some project, and I've calculated its internal rate of return. Okay, now, I am going to bring that project to your attention, sir. You are my financial analyst. Okay, I want you to tell me whether we're a go or a no-go on this with a discount rate of 5%. You should be able to tell me right instantly.
Yes.
Because any discount rate below the internal rate of return yields a negative net present value. You see that profile? Any discount rate below the internal rate of return of a project makes it a positive NPV. So once you've computed the internal rate of return, you are basically done. All you have to do is wait for me to tell you a discount rate to use. You don't even have to calculate the discount rate. Once you've got the internal rate of return, you're done with the project. That's it. Game over. Okay? That's what's so nice about the internal rate of return. It has a dark side, though. It has a dark side. And one of the things that's kind of, aside from the criticisms I have of this of the textbook you're using, we do they are quite glib, as anyone in finance is, that out there in the real world, internal rate of return is used way too much. Internal rate of return has an internal flaw in it that can get you into a world of trouble. However, the internal rate of return is still a lot better than another method that business classes, I didn't start in business classes. I just sort of fell into that because no one else wanted me at Ohio State. They were showing these methods that were old school methods. And it's just like, who would ever think of using something that stupid? Until I became a consultant and I found out that almost everybody was using something that stupid. The most commonly used method, and I still, to this day, run into companies that are using it, is something called the payback period method. Now, the payback period method essentially says, all right, our company has a policy that any project we take on has to pay back the initial investment within a certain number of years. The company has a policy. I ran into a company, our payback period is 4 years. Our payback period is 2 years. So in other words, you would have a company, let's say they have a payback period is 4 years. Now, suppose that the profile was $10,000 out now. 1 year, that's 10,000. 1 year, 2,500. Another year, 44,000. Third year, 3,000. Fifth year, 8,000. Wait, no, fourth year, 1,000. Peters off, fifth year, 200, sixth year, 100. The payback period method says, all right, we set a payback number of years, or a number of months, some companies use. And then if the project pays itself back in that period of time, then we say yes to the project. So in this case, we've got a project that costs 10 grand up front, and then, yeah, it'll pay back in 4 years. But I'll tell you right now, that project could really suck, because the one thing the payback period doesn't do is it doesn't take into account the discounted, the present value. So in other words, this project begins to actually find its feet in years 2 and 3, and then it begins to die away. So this, if you were to discount those amounts back, they might not be worth very much right now. So the payback period method just doesn't take into account that you could have a huge amount of money come in the year of the payoff, the payback period. And it could be a yes, but if you discounted that value back to the present, that's not a lot of money. But it's still being used out there, and the book was showing that in 2013, there were still a lot of companies using it. Interestingly enough, slightly more companies in 2013 were using internal rate of return instead of net present value. In a survey that was done late last year of CFOs, we do see that it has turned around, and now NPV is being used by slightly more companies than internal rate of return. And that's just because we have finally leaning muscle into it in these classes. Here's the big problem with internal rate of return, and here's where real world sets in. Not most, but a lot of projects aren't just we throw money in and then we get positive cash flow out forever. A lot of projects out there, you put money in, and then you get positive money out, revenue. But then you throw a pile of money in again and you lose money in maybe year three, year four, year five, something like that. Because you've got to go through a design innovation, or you've got to modify the product based upon consumer response or based upon regulatory changes. And so what will happen is that a lot of projects don't have one sign switch. They have more than one sign switch in the cash flow. See how this one was simple. Sign switch from negative to positive, one sign switch. However, a lot of projects out there have more than one sign switch. They'll go negative to positive to negative to positive. I saw that in consulting. Matter of fact, probably more than half the companies I consulted for, they would have a project, they would spend a lot of money on it, then they would get in revenue. But before that revenue got too strong, they would have to spend a pile of money to open up new markets or to redesign the product, or in one case, to handle a change in the EPA's regulatory structure, regulations. So if that happens, you key this into your computer to find the net present, the internal rate of return, it'll give you a number, just like I did for this one. I'm going to show you here in a minute. But there's actually more than one internal rate of return. The net present value profile, actually is a parabola. It's not even a parabola. It's actually, it's shaped like this. It could be where you have two internal rates of return. The calculator will give you the one that it started looking closest to, but it will have no clue that there was a second one. You've even got projects where you can have this happen. And the calculator, it's not going to tell you that there's multiple internal rates of return, because it's going to be starting, it'll start its calculations here, and it'll say, found it right here. See, I'm a good boy. But it won't tell you that there were these other internal rates of return. So which one's right? None of them are right. It's completely what we call in math a spurious result. There is no internal rate of return. It's just it's a meaningless thing when the cash flow switches sign more than once. So that's a danger with internal rate of return. Don't use it unless there's only one sign switch. In the next lecture, I'll show you there's something called the modified internal rate of return, which can, in a back-ass sort of way, it can actually correct for this problem. The way the modified internal rate of return works, and I'm not going to show that one to you today, it takes all the positive cash flows and finds their present value this way. It takes all the negative, it takes the negatives this way, it takes the positives this way, and then it takes the present value of the positive here and brings it back and compares it. Anyway, enough of that. However, let me show you what let's get away from all that stuff right now and go back here. It looks like for this simple problem that we did that the internal rate of return looks to be, about 6.5%. So let's see if the calculator can give it to us. Compute the internal rate of return. Well, there it is. Look how easy that. Believe me, back in the day, we would actually have to just keep calculating back and forth using interest rates until we got the one that had the NPV equals zero to a certain number of decimal places. That was way too much like work. As you can see, we now see that the internal rate of return of this project is 6.44%. And in this case, that's a valid number. Now I'm going to take you to the next thing. How are internal rates of return used in the real world? One way that they are used is to say that a company will calculate its weighted average cost of capital. In other words, how much does its stock cost it? How much does the coupons on its bonds cost it? What is the overall capital structure cost? And then they say, all right, whatever projects we select, we are going to select only those that have an internal rate of return larger than our cost of capital. So in other words, I could say, all right, the weighted average cost of capital for this company is 7.5%. adding up the cost of the coupons on the debt, the cost of the stock that the company sells, and the cost of the stockholders the company already has, the cost of any preferred stock. I take the weighted average of those, and it comes out to be 7.5%. Well, this project has an internal rate of return of 6.44%. So I would reject the project because it did not cover the weighted average cost of capital. You see how this project is negative at 7.5%? That means that this project just can't pay for the money, the funds we raised to do the project. And so that's how, what it's used for. This, by the way, when I say the 7.5% here, or whatever the company decides, companies have a name for this. It's almost always, I've seen a few variations on it, but it's almost always called a hurdle rate. A hurdle rate. A hurdle rate is set by a company, and it is the lowest internal rate of return that the company will take projects on. The hurdle rate, and let me say that quite formally, the hurdle rate is the rate that all projects must exceed with their internal rates of return. The rate that all projects must exceed, E-X-C-E-E-D, exceed in terms of their internal rates of return. So in other words, if you were to tell me, well, I've got a project here and I found its internal rate of return is 8.9%, we just say go. Well, I got a project here, it's pretty good, but it's got an internal rate of return of 4.6%, I say no. It's like the net present value, except for one big problem. The question is, where do you suppose the company came up with its hurdle rate? Where would you guess? Do you suppose they used mathematics and calculations and supercomputers? They hired financial analysts with incredible personalities like me and no slouching technical skills? No. They usually pulled it right out of their rumps. There was a company, swear to you, it was 1997, I was consulting for a company, and I was just talking with the CFO, we were having dinner, and he started mentioning hurdle rates. And I said, well, hurdle rates, you use those? And he said, oh yeah, we got a hurdle rate. Our hurdle rate is 12.3%. I said, well, where did that come from? And he just got quiet. He said, you know, I'm not sure. It's always been there since I've been with the company. Wait. You mean someone set this like 10,000 years ago, you never bothered to change it with changing interest rates in the macroeconomic environment? Oh, no, that's just what we use. Well, who's in charge of changing? He said, I don't know, but we always use it, always have, and we always will. So it's like, where is the criterion? And you would have to change the hurdle rate. Like if interest rates in the whole economy begin to sink down, well, you would want your hurdle rate to go down too. Interest rates go up, you'd want your hurdle rate to go up. That wasn't how it worked. It was just pulled out of the ass of someone. And I said, you do see the flaw in this logic. He could not see that there was something wrong with that. And that's one of the things that is going to drive you crazy in business. It's going to be so clear to you from modern methods, and yet you're going to be dealing with these people who basically are still living in an Amish paradise. Or something like that, to quote Al Yankovic. The hurdle rate is out there, though, and it's very common. And like I said, net present value, you have to find a discount rate by scientific methods. And you will see that in a couple of weeks. It's called the capital asset pricing model. We can find a discount rate. And it's not even that hard to. I mean, it's funny because in the classes that I teach that are above this class, I teach the same thing just because so many of the finance students forget it and I want to make sure they remember it. It's a classic formula. But again, though, it's just a yes or no. The hurdle rate, the internal rate of return decision method is a yes or no, too. And that's what it boils down to. Now, here is the problem with all of these methods. And it's gotten to be more and more of a problem in the last few generations. I've seen it building up in my lifetime, and it's like a bullet going through your thinking in this generation. You see, and the only companies that can overcome this, that are not propelled and beaten and driven by it, are oligopolies. Because the difference is between oligopolies and monopolistic competition and perfect competition is that oligopolies price and plan strategically. They don't work by these models exactly. Here's the thing. I could have a project that was absolutely miserable on cash flow very early, or for 5 years, 10 years. Only in long out there years would the project actually begin to pick up power and have massive free cash flows that were positive. In the early years, it would have negative, 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 and then when it started to have positive, they would be pathetic for another decade, 2 decades. But then in 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, you start to see the massive, ungodly positive free cash flows. Those would be rejected by any of these criteria. Net present value, even if I had billions of dollars, if it was 50 years out, its present value would be pittance. The same with internal rate of return. I mean, those early cash flows have such heavy influence that long out there, cash flows, no matter how big they are, no matter how important they are, they don't work. So in other words, you are not going to see companies in perfect competition and in monopolistic competition doing projects like mining asteroids, like building space tourism, like creating fusion reactors, like creating spheres and shells in which we can then house large numbers of people on other planets, like throwing probes to other parts, to nearby star systems for us to be able to populate when our Earth goes to hell in about 100 years. We don't do those because the positive present cash flows are way out there. Decades, many, many decades out there. And so we have to leave that to these oligopolies, which don't think in terms of the way of net present values. They think in strategic terms. You see, we will wipe out our oil reserves. That's normal. Of course we're going to. We're going to use them up. And we're going to do a lot of damage to the environment on the way. But the oligopolies are already planning for what comes after that. Because they don't plan for 5 years, 10 years. They plan for 50 years, 100 years out there. So keep that in mind when you're doing these kinds of projects. Great for the regular average business projects, but it sucks when you're talking about things that would benefit civilizations and the planet itself. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.